50 out of 100 cases, the worker, the Muslim worker, can avoid selling or dealing with the bottles of alcohol or with the containers of alcohol. He can, for example, if he's supposed to put things on the shelf or on showcases, or maybe move things from around. Mm-hmm. He can move things that are basically halal, okay? Not those things which are like, for example, alcohol, which is
But if the owner of the store doesn't allow the salesperson, the Muslim salesperson, to shirk this responsibility to not to sell or refuse to sell, for example, such haram things.
Yes.
What happens? Does he have to or she have to quit the job or not? No.
There are different assumptions, okay?
Yes.
Sometimes if you quit the job, okay, you will end up facing difficulties and hardships, and
exactly.
You will, of course, you will not be able to find a job, and your family will suffer. And in which case, of course, you can continue doing the job, and even if you are supposed to do things which are not allowable. Mm-hmm. But the money that comes from this, from the alcohol that you sell, is not halal to own. You know,
right? Right.
You are not going to take possession of that money.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to separate it, you have to take it out, and you cannot take possession
and
of the money.
And if it is not possible to separate the money? Because you are working as just a simple, regular salesperson in a big supermarket.
No, for example, you're going to... You're
not
going to
separate the money earned at the end.
You're not going to do it. For example, how long does it take you to move one thing, okay? A bottle of wine or alcohol. It takes you, let's say, 1 minute to do it,
mm-hmm.
and for the rest of the remaining time, you always, do things which are halal.
Mm-hmm.
So how much will it be in terms of percentage?
Uh-huh.
I think it will be a very meager amount.
Right.
So it could be $1 out of 1,000.
I see.
So you just take out that $1 as the proceeds, or maybe the money, the salary,
okay,
that comes for the sale or against the sale of the thing which it was haram.
And then if that is the case, then he has to separate the money based on the percentage, as you said,
sure, of course.
Allocated to the time.
To the time.
Yeah. But who should he give the money to?
The money should be given back, or maybe to the owner, to whatever. He cannot take it. And of course,
And can he give it to the poor, like the beggars
on
the street?
Yeah, he can give it, because he cannot own it. But he cannot, that's not his money. He can give it to anyone, but not to a Muslim or to someone.
To a non-Muslim.
To a non-Muslim
needy,
or to someone who is needy, he can give it.
I see.
Because he's not going to return it to a Muslim. So to the owner of the
mm-hmm.
of the company or the store.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, for your nice comments and answers to the questions. Related to the business here in the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. For me and the rest of the crew, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun Rahimun Mannanun Kareemun Salamun Aleemun Malajah ilaha illahum Ghaffarun تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. For humanity means we have to be generous people. Generosity means we have to give other fellow human beings. Generosity means to have mercy in our hearts towards other fellow human beings. There are millions of people, if not billions of people around the world, suffering. And sometimes the people around us are suffering, our friends and family members that we know their condition is less. But we don't care, do we? We are just greedy people. Greed is the disease of the century. Greed is a disease that affects the hearts and the minds of people. We are constantly being told to care about ourselves, to work hard to make money. But we never asked ourselves, then what? I made money, then what? I got a house, then what? So it's only me, me, me. What about my other fellow human beings? What about my akhirah? What about my faith? Now, when it comes to greed, greed comes with so much negative impacts on the human being in terms of spirituality. And greed kills spirituality. The one thing greed does, it makes a person very, very far away from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The hadith from our 8th Imam, Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha alayhi salamullah, he says, As-sakha'u shajaratu min al-jannah. Generosity is a tree from heaven. And he says, فَمَنْ تَعَلَّقَ بِغَصْنٍ مِّنْهَا أَدْنَتْهُ إِلَى الْجَنَّةِ. And whoever holds on to a branch of it, it will take him to heaven. وَالْبُخْلُ شَجَرَةٌ فِي النَّارِ. And stinginess and greed is a tree in hell. And then he says, فَمَنْ تَعَلَّقَ بِغَصْنٍ مِّنْهَا أَدْنَتْهُ إِلَى النَّارِ. And whoever holds on to a branch of it, it will take him to hellfire. وَإِيَّاكُمْ مِنَ النَّارِ. And I warn you of hellfire. So greed is that tree that is here, that if I indulge in it, it will take me to hellfire. Taking me to hellfire means that it keeps me away from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It keeps me away from spirituality. Imam Sadiq salamullah alayhi says, صانع المعروف وحسن البشر يكسبان المحبة ويدخلان الجنة. He said, those who do good deeds and those who have good akhlaq, حسن البشر, like the, you know, smiley and easygoing, he says, this will make you make more friends and people will love you, will get you in heaven. And then he says, وَالْبُخْلُ وَأَبْسُ الْوَجْهِ. And stinginess and greed and frowning in the face, يُبْعِدَانِ مِنَ اللَّهِ وَيَدْخُلَانِ النَّارِ. They keep you away from the Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and they make you enter hell. So spirituality-wise, it does kill spirituality when a person becomes greedy. On the other hand, giving to others, helping others, that definitely takes spirituality to a new level. Let us take a short break and then we will come back right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. So we were looking at the negative impacts greed and stinginess has on the human being, and especially on the mu'min, because obviously I'm not talking to Bill Gates, am I? Or Elon Musk. So the hadith says another deadly effect of greed and stinginess is that it wipes out faith. A person becomes faithless. The hadith says, من عرف الله خافه, whoever knows Allah will be afraid of him. ومن خاف الله حثه الخوف على العمل بطاعة الله. And whoever knows Allah, then that should bring him to be fearful of Allah, and that fear will make him work for the sake of Allah. And then the Imam says, فبشر المطيعين المتأدبين بآداب الله. Then give glad tidings to those who are God obedient and they are following the morals of Allah. وَالْآخَذِينَ عَنَ اللَّهِ. And those who take from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And the Imam continues until he says, وَمَا رَأَيْتُ شَيْئًا هُوَ أَضَرُّ لِلدِّينِ. And I have seen nothing that's more destructive to the faith of a Muslim, لدين المسلم, من الشح, than greed. There is nothing more destructive to the faith of a person more than greed. Greed destroys the faith of a person. Because a greedy person is a person who says, I don't want to give because I lose. And that kind of belief that you're losing in terms of giving, it means you don't trust Allah enough to give you. And it means that in the hereafter, you don't believe in Allah's reward. Because if a person who's greedy, who believes that Allah will reward him in the hereafter, then he would be generous. He wouldn't be greedy. So in the dunya, he believes Allah will not sustain him. And in the akhirah, he believes Allah will not reward him. That is what faith is all about, isn't it? That will take it out. That will cancel it out. And then that's why the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam says, مَا مَحَقَ الْإِسْلَامَ مَحْقَ الشُّحِشَيْ. There is nothing that can wipe out Islam as much as greed. And then he says, إِنَّ لِهَذَا الشُّحِ دَبِيبٌ كَدَبِيبِ النَّمْلِ وَشُعْبًا كَشُعْبِ الشِّرْكِ. He says, this greed and this stinginess is like an ant. It walks like an ant. It can't be heard. And slips in the heart of a person like shirk does without realizing it. As Muslims, as believers of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, as followers of the Ahl Bayt alayhim as-salam, we have to be sure we don't fall in that trap of greed. Giving is such an act that is so heavy on the, let's call them weak believers. I wouldn't call them the fake believers, because sometimes we might be faking our belief. Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he says, وَالدِّينُ لَعَقٌ عَلَىٰ أَلْسِنَتِهِمْ. Faith, it's just a word on the tongues. إِذَا مُحْحُصُ بِالْبَلَاءِ قَلَّ الدَّيَّانُونَ. When they are trialed, then the truly religious people are very few. Because now everyone says, I'm a believer. Say to them, okay, pay, help out. No one would. And when you give someone a loan, you want it back. If someone asks you for a loan and he's in need, say to them, take it, you know. Allah Kareem, inshallah, whenever you have time, you can give. That's true generosity. How much of these people do we have these days? I don't know. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi.
In the limelight.
Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement slammed the Saudi-led coalition for failing to renew the United Nations brokered ceasefire deal amid deteriorating humanitarian crisis in the impoverished Arab country. The movement said the coalition of aggression is responsible for the failures to extend the truce deal and worsening humanitarian conditions. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Yemen's Al Masira News Network reports that the leader of Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement demanded an end to the Saudi-led war on his country, calling on the Yemeni nation to continue to resist the Saudi aggression, which has been supported by the United States of America and the Israeli regime. In a recent speech to mark the birth anniversary of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, Abdul Malik al-Houthi urged the war coalition to stop the aggression, to lift the siege on Yemen, and to end the occupation of the country. He also called on our dear people to continue confronting the aggression as long as it continues. Elsewhere in his remarks, Abdul Malik al-Houthi said the United States and the Israeli regime, as well as their acolytes, seek to enslave nations. He said the United States and Israel have directed all their endeavors towards bringing people out of light and into darkness. Tens of thousands of Yemenis flocked recently to the squares in the capital, Sana'a, and other cities to celebrate the Holy Prophet of Islam's birthday anniversary. The participants urged Muslims across the world to stand against Western imperialism. They held banners against the United States and Israel, which have supported the Saudi-led military aggression against their country. The rallies came just a few days after a United Nations brokered truce arrangement between the Ansarullah movement and the coalition came to an end. The truce first came into effect on 2nd of April, for an initial 2-month period and was extended twice until 2nd of October. Saudi Arabia and its allies, most notably the United Arab Emirates, have been waging a war against Yemen since March of 2015, trying in vain to reinstall the exiled regime of Abdurrahb Mansour Hadi. The military campaign, which has been enjoying unstinting arms, logistical and political support from the United States, has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and turned the entire country into the scene of the world's worst humanitarian disaster. In recent months, Yemeni officials have issued stern warnings to the Israeli regime about its role in supporting the Saudi war in Yemen. In a warning to the Saudi-led coalition and the countries supporting it, Yemen's defense minister said recently that the country's armed forces are capable of hitting targets far beyond Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Yemen's defense minister, Major General Mohammed al-Atifi, said, "We will never hesitate to bombard very sensitive and important facilities, and we will include them in the list of our future targets." Fast News Agency explains more about the same story. Yemen's Ansar Allah Popular Resistance Movement said a Saudi-led coalition, which has been attacking the country since 2015, is entirely responsible for the failure of a United Nations brokered truce arrangement between Sana'a and the aggressors. Spokesman Mohammed Abdel Salam made the remarks in a tweet on Thursday, 13th of October, saying the ceasefire ended and was not extended due to the aggressor country's disregard for humanitarian demands and natural rights of the Yemeni people. The United Nations-mediated truce arrangement expired on 2nd of October amid the invading coalition's constant violations of the agreement and its refusal to properly lift the siege that it has been enforcing against Yemen simultaneously with the war. Mohammed Abdel Salam also named some of the obstacles that the coalition has been throwing in the way of truce's extension. He said the coalition had refused to reopen the Sana'a International Airport and Yemen's lifeline, Al-Hudaydah, the port of Al-Hudaydah, and denied that the government in Sana'a access to the country's oil and gas wealth so it can pay the Yemeni people's salaries. The spokesman noted, "Peace in Yemen is not possible unless the invading countries abandon their arrogant mentality." Meanwhile, the Yemeni foreign minister said there will be no talks about extension of the United Nations brokered truce arrangement until the nation's legitimate demands are fully met, stressing that the Sana'a-based National Salvation Government will make every effort to establish just and dignified peace throughout the war-torn country. Hisham Sharaf made the remark at a meeting with the Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations for Humanitarian Affairs and Deputy Emergency Relief Coordinator in the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Joyce Masuya. The meeting took place in Sana'a, the Yemeni capital, recently. The Yemeni Foreign Minister, Hisham Sharaf, emphasized that the only solution to offset the adverse consequences of the ongoing humanitarian disaster in Yemen is to immediately stop the Saudi-led aggression, to lift the sanctions against Yemen, and end any kind of foreign military presence on Yemeni soil. Al-Mayadeen television network covers the same story from a different angle. A senior member of Yemen's popular Ansar Allah resistance movement warned the country's armed forces will target oil facilities deep inside Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates in case the Yemeni people's rights are not fulfilled. Recently, Mohammed al-Bukhaiti, a member of Ansar Allah's political bureau, said Yemeni people have their rightful demands. He warned that Yemen's army has the ability to target Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates oil installations if those demands are not met. Moreover, a spokesman for the Yemeni Armed Forces, Brigadier General Yahya Sari, also warned that foreign companies with operations in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates to immediately leave those two countries. In a post on his Twitter account, spokesman for the Yemeni Armed Forces, Brigadier General Sari, renewed the warning for foreign firms stationed in the two aggressive countries. He said they should move their operations to other countries, to other less risky countries, in order to prevent further losses. Earlier, Brigadier General Sari had noted the warning will stay in place as long as the US Saudi-led aggressive aggression countries are not committed to a truce deal and give the Yemeni people the right to exploit their oil wealth in favor of the salary of the Yemeni state employees. He also asked the United Nations to step up its humanitarian programs in Yemen to provide the crisis-hit country with more food and more medical supplies, as well as financial aid.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
علامتش میدونید چیه؟ از کجا تشخیص بدیم که خستگی کاذبه؟
How can we recognize that our sense of boredom and religious laziness is fake or real? The best way is when you feel tired, you continue your act of worship. Now, if your religious or spiritual boredom is unreal, by continuing your worship, it will leave you. Then you feel that you are not tired and are thirsty for more spiritual experience.
اما اگر رفتید جلو یه مقدار که ادامه دادید هی ببینید که نه واقعا خسته.
However, if you continue your spiritual experience and still you feel tired, that's the real type of spiritual laziness or boredom. This feeling is the inculcation of your carnal soul. If you are indifferent, it will leave you. Yet, if you go on with your good deeds and you are tired in that process, you are experiencing the real type of boredom, which is solvable. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website parstoday.com/en Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. السلام علیکم و رحمت الله و برکاته. Dear listeners, sisters and brothers from all around the world, I hope you all doing well. This is IRIB English Radio and I'm at your service from Youth Station. I'm Beta and I'm a medical student who is interested in different topics and discussions that we'll have in this episode. And with me, I have my dear brother, Rohani. Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me in this discussion. I'm a student of Islamic Hawza, but I got my PhD in Islamic philosophy.
Yeah, that's a pleasure to have you with me for this episode. Today, we're going to talk about something really interesting, which actually this is my question too. I am a candidate for youth generation.
I will try my best, inshallah, to have some pieces of advices for our friends or brothers and sisters as their brother or as their teacher, because I'm also a teacher. So inshallah, I try to share my own inshallah ideas and opinions regarding your questions.
As you know, there are some Islamic centers in different countries, such as non-Islamic countries and Western European countries. And what are the main features of Islamic centers in European countries to track this sort of generation?
Yes, of course, it's a very nice and important question that should be dealt with in this kind of debates, or we can say dialogue and discussions.
Yeah.
First of all, what is very much important regarding these, the features of the Islamic centers in non-Islamic societies and countries, is this, that these centers should actually deliver the youth some good ideas. to help them to have a better life in those societies. So, of course, these ideas should be new, should be rational, should be, we can say, logical, in a way that should convince the youth, the young generation, and it should be satisfactory. So, of course, these centers should be like kind of training centers that should train the youth, the young generation. This is the first point, I think, in terms of training and education, we can say. And the other thing is that, of course, in these kind of centers, we should have good kind of teachers, scholars, to have a good kind of communication and relationship with the youth.
Yeah.
They should attract the youth by their good behaviors, by their good treatments with the students or with the youth. That is also really, really important. We have some scholars in some of the Islamic centers in the West. They spend lots of times with the youth. They sometimes go exercising, doing some kind of sports with them, having team.
Yeah.
So this kind of things for the youth is very much important. So that's why this kind of centers should entertain a little bit the youth as well.
Actually, that was a beautiful answer for me. But you know what? The youth generation is somehow rebellious, you know. This is Islamic center. And for example, there is a question in my mind that why should I go to Islamic center for entertainment? You know, there are other schools, there are other places for doing the same thing. You know, what actually differentiate these centers in different countries, non-Islamic countries especially?
Of course, of course. As you rightly mentioned, you might find this kind of entertainment in some other centers and some other places. But the point is, and the very important point is this, that this entertainment should be in accordance with the Islamic principles, with the Islamic values, with the Islamic rulings. That is why it makes it completely different from what you may find in other centers and other places. So that is why we can say a kind of true entertainment or correct kind of entertainment.
You are telling me that these entertainments, these beautiful, actually attractive things should be according to the rules of Islam. And, you know, some youth generation may think like, okay, if it is according to the rule of Islam, it may have some limitations. I don't want this limitation. What should I do?
Mm-hmm. So this kind of limitation, you know, whenever you are, wherever you are, you have limitations.
Yeah.
So in this world, wherever you live, you have some limitations.
But some extra limitations,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, of course. Limitations are always there. But the point is that we should understand that why I should, for example, have these limitations. Why should I, for example, let's say, cooperate with this kind of limitation? This is an important point.
Yeah.
And that should be explained by the teachers, by the scholars, by the people who are educating the students, who are, for example, the teachers, like teaching them, training them. And of course, this kind of things should be explained, because if we understand, okay, these limitations are helpful for me, are good for me, and it will help me to improve, to get lots of achievements in my life. So of course, then that limitations it themselves become enjoyable.
We were talking about the attractive features of Islamic center in the West countries and non-Islamic countries. And you told me that we have to have some entertainment for youth generation according to the Islamic rule. And actually, there is limitation. But wherever you go, there is limitation. So they cannot actually have a nice time in that kind of centers, or they cannot be attractive. So if you do agree with me, we're going to go for a break. Then we're going to come back and go on with that conversation. Dear listeners, go for a short break. Stay tuned. Welcome back. This is Youth Station. We're talking about the attractive features of Islamic centers in non-Islamic countries. As my dear brother told you, there are some actually ways that we can make it more attractive. But I want to tell you that first thing, which is I think really important, and most of the time all the other generations are ignorant about that, is the youth generation, you know, has somehow some special features, some special personnel, some special mindset, and there is no effort to actually actually know these kind of mindsets which exist in our youth generation? What is the reason? And is it like that exactly?
First of all, it is the responsibility of those people who, for example, build or establish a center for the youth. So this, first of all, I think it goes to them to understand the youth. Of course, these kind of people should have good communication, friendly kind of relationship with the youth. Otherwise, they will not be able to understand them. So that's why it's better that, for example, the scholars, the teachers themselves should be young, a bit young, so that they could get the ideas, the mindset, the viewpoints of the young generation and the youth. They could help them better. For example, they can go with them to some sports, play with them, for example, some sports, and entertain them and, let's say, discuss them, debate them. So if this kind of things would be found in those kind of centers, it will be much more helpful for both the scholars as well as the youth. And
this is a nice point, I think, to use the youth generation for the youth generation, you know, to grow them up. But there is a problem here. For example, me as a candidate for youth generation, I'm here and, you know, it's like, for example, if somebody at my age tell me what to do or what not to do, or, for example, try to teach me something, it is somehow annoying for me because, you know, this thought that, you know, this person is as same as me and here he think or she thinks that she's superior than me. And this feeling, I think, is destructive. What do you think about it?
You know, sometimes, for example, you have in your school, in your high school or sometimes in university, some young teachers.
Yeah.
They are young, but since they teach you in a perfect way, they are very much knowledgeable, they are very much skillful. In that case, of course, you would listen to them, to these kind of teachers, though they are young. And I, as I told you, they should be a bit young, not at this, at the same age of that youth or the young generation. Of course, there should be a kind of a difference between
age
them
gap.
In terms of age, of course. And of course, the physical attraction is also important. I mean, physically, also the center should be attractive.
Exactly.
It should not be in a way that, for example, when the youth come to that center, they do not feel, for example, comfortable in that center. Of course, this is also very much important.
I do agree with that point. I think the youth generation is always interested in, for example, beautiful things. And this beauty, you know, should be shown in different centers in non-Islamic countries, actually. But the problem, I think, here is that these countries are non-Islamic. And there are many factors, many other things, many other beauties that will be actually make us attracted to them, you know. And, for example, we're not in an Islamic country that you can tell me that, okay, everybody is doing that, so you have to do the same thing. You have to convince me to do that. And the ways that you can convince me, I think, are somehow complicated. And we need to actually train and teach people, special people, to do this important responsibility. And unfortunately, in my opinion, actually, this responsibility is somehow ignored. And we don't actually pay as much attention as we should. And this is actually the problem of these kind of societies. One of the features which can be so attractive is actually strengthen the bond with God. I think the youth generation lack this part, you know, a lot in her or his life. We always are struggling with the problem of finding our identity. And I think one important aspect of identity is actually a religion. There is a problem here. Somehow the older generation think in a way that because we are young, we cannot understand. And if we are explained, for example, we cannot even understand anymore. And this is the problem. I think there should be less gap between us, and we have to speak to each other about these matters that we can understand, actually. If you tell us, if you believe in us, we will grow more and more and more. What do you do, actually, in your day-to-day life to lessen this gap between your generation and my generation?
And of course, I do agree with you that, you know, the people who have kind of contact or, let's say, relationship and communication with the young generation, with the youth, first of all, they should tolerate sometimes the different viewpoints or different, let's say, behaviors or treatments of the youth. They should bear it. They should tolerate it. And then they should respect them. And this is the point that they should attract their trust to themselves. Yeah. So how this way that should they should give time, they should spend time with them, sitting with them, and listening to them, asking them questions. When they ask, we should listen carefully to the questions to understand what is in their mind. And the, if the questions of the youth would be answered, answered very profoundly, we can say, or perfectly, in that case, of course, they will listen automatically. They will listen to you, and they will accept you, and they will follow you. Of course, this is the responsibility of the older generation to listen, to understand, to satisfy, to convince the youth in a way that the youth accept him or believe in him or believe in this older generation.
Yeah.
Of course, it needs a kind of friendly kind of relationship. It should not be that much formal kind of relationship.
Yeah, I do agree.
They should be like friends. And of course, they should sit together sometimes for maybe for some hours to talk, to discuss, to debate, to challenge each other, to ask questions, and finally to find out the best solution, the best answers for the important questions.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Actually, thank you for your pieces of advice. I think it was useful actually for me, and somehow I got the answer to my question. I wish that was useful for the listeners too. So actually, as you know, we talked about the features that we have to make in Islamic centers to make it more attractive. And at the end, we actually received this point that we have to make a friendlier communication with youth generation, and this generation gap should be lessened. And when you try and when you spend time, both generations will understand each other more. And there is a solution for this problem, and this is spending time. You have to talk to them, and you have to try and struggle to actually put yourself in their shoes. And I think this is the most important point that we have to actually meet in all of the centers. Thank you for listening to this episode. This is all the time that we have for today. And I bid you farewell, and I leave you in the warm embrace of God. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Bahrain has held its general elections. The regime was delighted. Authorities in the Sunni-ruled state, which crushed a 2011 anti-government uprising, said that the vote was free and put the turnout at 73%. But the vote was anything but free and fair. Rights groups called the voting environment of what is supposed to be a democratic process as political repression. They said there were highly restrictive measures that barred members of banned opposition groups. They added holding this general election will not address the atmosphere of repression and the denial of human rights that has gripped Bahrain for years. This, in essence, would make the vote a sham, that it would be void of holding any value. It was no surprise that Bahrainis took to the streets to protest the electoral process and announced that they would boycott the election, since it served the political trajectory of the ruling class. Bahrain experienced an uprising in 2011, still ongoing till this day, in which the Bahraini regime dissolved the main opposition groups and cracked down on dissent. The regime's crackdown over the past 12 years has been brutal. According to a 61-page report, the court is satisfied with the confession. Bahrain death sentences follow torture, sham trials. The regime has arbitrarily arrested more than 20,000 and tortured more than 6,000 victims. This also includes extrajudicial killings of more than 200 and political death sentences, the dissolution of opposition political societies, and the demolition of 38 mosques. and this is happening in a Persian Gulf country that is a key ally of the U.S. in the region, home to the U.S.'s Navy's 5th Fleet, and also the United Kingdom, which opened a permanent military base in 2018. The powerful Shia cleric Sharissa Qassam has said that the election means normalization. He said the elections constitute a test of the populace's awareness, explaining that to elect means opening the door for Bahraini citizenship-bearing Israelis to vote for parliament members. This would translate into how the electorate, meaning soldiers, dual citizens, security forces, those with personal interests in mind, and normalization advocates, would create a parliament for the government and not the people. The double standard approach by the UK and the US stands out when it comes to the issue of human rights and Bahrain. After all, Bahraini courts have convicted and sentenced defendants to death following manifestly unfair trials, based solely or primarily on confessions, allegedly coerced through torture and ill treatment. The governments of the US and the UK, as well as the European Union and its member states, should urge Bahrain, through both public and diplomatic channels, to halt all executions and to seriously investigate torture allegations and violations of the right to a fair trial. Yet they have chosen to do that with other countries, for example, Iran, which ironically has rioters out on the streets, endangering Iran's national security. According to Iran's intelligence minister, both the US and the UK even have a hand in the deadly protests, like to the CIA. A recent visit of the Pope to Bahrain posed an opportunity for the plight of Bahrainis to be addressed. 130 human rights organizations appealed to the Pope of the Vatican to demand the release of prisoners of conscience in Bahrain. They asked him to adopt an initiative urging the Bahraini authorities to end violations. But those hopes are dim. These 130 human rights organizations have cited how so many Bahrainis have faced discrimination, jail time, and torture. Yet Bahrain has always shifted the blame to Iran for the unrest. Could 130 human rights organizations be wrong, or for them to be lying? But Bahrain ultimately cannot have a democratic process because its big brother Saudi Arabia, which is just a stone's throw away, will be threatened by democracy taking place next door and will vehemently reject this, since it cannot risk having democracy creep into the kingdom. After all, Bahrain is joined only by a causeway to Saudi Arabia.
Hussein Amir Abdullahian warns of negative consequences if the UNHRC were to go ahead with demands of the West. He criticized the Western double standards when it comes to the issue of human rights. In a phone call with UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, he said, "Contrary to the UN Charter, few Western countries exploited the peaceful demands in Iran and encouraged violence and offered tutorials on building weapons and Molotov cocktails on media and social networks, which led to the killing of police and insecurity in Iran." He says that if a session is to be held on the riots in Iran, it should in fact probe into foreign governments' role in encouraging violence and terror and not on the country that is a true defender of human rights. What Amir Abdullahian is referring to is the piling evidence of actual foreign involvement in the riots, perhaps the most compelling of which was revealed through a joint statement by Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps and the Ministry of Intelligence. In it, the country's two top intelligence bodies pointed out the major role of foreign intelligence agencies, especially the CIA, in orchestrating the riots. They revealed that they have gone as far as dividing the riots in different stages of pre-unrest, during unrest, and post-unrest. Perhaps the primary way foreign governments, especially the US, UK, and Saudi Arabia, were involved was through supporting foreign Farsi-speaking media that played on people's emotions over a tragic death and capitalized on existing grievances to attempt to overthrow the Islamic establishment through something like a coup d'etat. Iran has warned the UK of consequences for hosting the so-called Iran International Channel, which Iran has recognized as a terrorist organization. Iran also warned Germany for voicing its support for the rioters and calling on the EU to implement more sanctions against Iran. Amir Saeed Iravani, Iran's permanent representative to the United Nations, responded to the U.S. cries of women's rights and human rights being violated in Iran and its calls for a special session to, quote, highlight the ongoing repression of women and girls and members of religious and ethnic minority groups by saying this. The United States lacks the political, moral, and legal qualifications to hold such a meeting, distorting the very basic principles of human rights. He also added, the U.S. has no true and genuine concern about the human rights situation in Iran or elsewhere. Perhaps he was referring to the role that the U.S. has been playing in destabilizing the West Asia region and carrying out terrorist attacks there. Yemen, Syria, Afghanistan, and Libya, and its unwavering support for Israeli crimes against Palestinians, don't even begin to tell the whole story on U.S.'s destabilizing acts in the region. The U.K.'s involvement in Syria, funding terrorist groups, and being one of the coalition members of the fight against Yemen also nullifies their cries over human rights violations anywhere in the world.
As the war drags on in Ukraine, the gloomy economic outlook continues to trigger protests across Europe. Demonstrators in several European countries have hit the streets for pay rises and better working conditions. In the UK, tens of thousands of nurses will go on a strike for the first time, demanding better pay as the cost of living soars. The industrial action would begin before the end of the year, after the first vote on strike action in its 106-year-old history. Unions say that the salaries of nurses have dropped by up to 20% in real terms over the last 10 years. That has left members struggling to feed their families and to pay their bills. Hundreds of workers at London's Heathrow Airport will walk out in the run-up to the Soccer World Cup this month over demands for better pay. These 700 workers will strike for 3 days starting from November 18th. In Greece, workers have held a 24-hour general strike, which has seen thousands of protesters march to the streets of Athens and the northern city of Thessaloniki. Clashes also erupted between protesters and police forces. And the French capital, Paris, commuters have faced transport delays. As metro workers called a major one-day pay strike, unions have staged strikes across several sectors in recent weeks, seeking pay hikes or increased hiring, as spiraling energy costs feed into widespread inflation. The protests come amid a gloomy outlook in Europe as Russia's war in Ukraine takes a rising toll on Europe's economies. The International Monetary Fund has predicted that Europe's advanced economies will grow by just 0.6% next year. It also says that this winter, more than half of the countries in the euro area will experience technical recessions. Germany, which is considered EU's biggest economy, is also expected to go into a recession in the next year.
The German economy has been built on cheap energy, cheap gas from Russia. And this business model is over. So Germany has to fasten to produce renewable energy and then go back on track with its business model. But this will take a couple of years.
Technically, a recession means that at least two consecutive quarters of shrinking output will occur. Next year, Europe's output and income will be nearly half a trillion euros lower as compared to the IMF's pre-war forecasts.
We have downgraded three times since October last year our growth projections. Last time we brought 22 to 3.2% growth, and for 23 projections was 2.9%. We will see, we always come around the annual meetings with our World Economic Outlook, that we are further downgrading our growth projections for next year.
The Eurozone has been battling against surging inflation for about a year. Inflation hit a historic high of 10.7% last month. Given the historic levels of inflation, the European Central Bank has announced three rate hikes this year, bringing the main rate from negative territory to 1.5% currently. Soaring costs with energy have been the main driver of higher inflation across the Eurozone.
From the insurrection in the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, to block the certification of the presidential election results to the October 28th attack on U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's home, these incidents are among the most high-profile instances of political violence in America in recent times. Now, many believe the problem has gone from bad to worse in recent weeks. Harassment of political candidates and voter intimidation have been reported in many parts of